Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm your host, Delcherie Gladden. I'm a USA Today bestselling author of over 30 published novels. On this week's episode, I have Neil McKee, and he's going to be talking about his newest book, My University of the World. Neil, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Well, I guess I'm World Wanderer. Ended up in New Mexico in 2015, which is a great place to do writing and meet people who do writing and think up new ideas. I was a filmmaker and media producer for most of my career, about 45 years, and that was in working in developing countries for a number of agencies. When I reached New Mexico, I started to write about my memories in memoirs, some of which have won awards. This one is subtitled, My University of the World. Subtitle is Adventures of an International Film and Media Maker. And it's a standalone sequel to my first travel memoir, Finding Myself in Borneo. That's what I do, and spend my time these days writing and promoting my books and meeting people who do the same sort of thing and other international groups here in Albuquerque and Santa Fe.
Well, I'm glad you made your way to this area and that I got a chance to get a copy of your book and learn more about what you've been doing, because you do have quite the interesting life story to share with people. It was really fascinating to be able to read how you got into this adventure and kind of where it took you over time. So I kind of wanted to start at the beginning. Tell people a little bit about how you got into filmmaking and working with these groups that you were a part of over the years.
Well, the first film I made was when I was a volunteer teacher in Borneo, and it's mentioned in this new book as well as in Finding Myself in Borneo. I was living with this American Peace Corps fellow who had a 16-millimeter camera and was making a film for the Peace Corps, and I wrote to CUSO, that's the Canadian University Service Overseas in Ottawa, and said, I can make a film for you, and they took me up on it. So my first film, although it wasn't used, was on CUSO volunteers in East Malaysia, Borneo. It was good enough to be hired. On my way home, I traveled through Thailand, India, and then into a number of African countries, shooting more films for them, and then going to work in Ottawa in a studio where I really learned filmmaking, working with a great woman editor who taught me what I was doing wrong, what I was doing right, and what I need to do differently when I went back out again to shoot more films.
Well, that was one of the things that I found really interesting about your getting started in all of this, was that you came from a non-traditional background. You didn't necessarily study this formally and then go through a process that might happen today. It was really kind of organic how you learned things, how opportunities kind of came at you in different ways. And I found that to be really interesting, because I think that in today's world, that would be a little harder to see that happen and to have things come together in the way that they did for you.
Yeah, I guess it was a lot of luck. I went to, when I was back in Ottawa filming or editing some of my films for CUSO, I went to Ryerson Polytechnical Institute, which taught filmmaking, and I showed them one of my films, the one on New Guinea, and they said, well, what do you want to do? We can't teach you anything more. You're in the best of situations for learning in an actual working studio. And I found at that time a lot of people had not really taken formal filmmaking as a study. They learned on the job. So I wasn't alone in that, but I would say I was pretty lucky to get into it when I did.
Absolutely. And it seems like you had some really fortunate connections that were made of people who were really helpful to you and willing to teach you and share their experience and knowledge.
That's right. I was assigned in Ottawa first to work with a lady by the name of Sally McDonald. It was just a wonderful teacher and listener. Wherever I went, I was working with people I would say became mentors. And again, lucky to meet people who actually took me to my next job.
I was really interested in your experience in learning to edit the films. I found that a really interesting part of your recollections in, because a lot of it, you learned how to do a lot of the post-production on your own, especially in the earlier films that you were making and having that guidance and going through it. What was that like, having gone out and shot all of this raw footage, and especially in your early projects where you were still kind of figuring out what the organizations wanted and how to put it all together in a story, and just taking that vast amount of footage that you had and figuring out how to put it together in the way that they were hoping you would to tell the story that they needed you to tell? What was that process like?
Well, from the first film I made, it just had too many long shots and mid shots and not enough close-ups. So I got when I got back on the road, leaving Malaysia and working in Thailand and India, I had a whole set of notes of things I had done wrong in my first film. Before I got back home, I was still receiving notes from Ottawa what I should do differently. And that is things like shoot many different angles when you're taking a scene. Lots of cutaways so that you can edit to the cutaway and then back to the main subject of the film. Get those close-ups, mid-shots, and a variety. Use your tripod as much as possible. That's what I did. I just applied myself to learning how to do it properly. And that's really what you would learn in film school.
Well, it's really neat that you were able to and really had the ambition to take those notes and to implement them. I think that can sometimes be a hard thing to do.
Yes, in those days, I started off making really films and recording the sound separately, but then I got into synchronized sound filming later. The biggest challenge I came after leaving CUSO, I went to an organization called the International Development Research Center of Canada, IDRC, which is still going today. And I was challenged with covering their projects around the world. The first set of films and photo sessions I did was going around the world, Latin America, then West Africa, East Africa, later in Asia, all the way through Southeast Asia, and then South Asia and into Iran. I covered 77 projects in 26 countries. I counted 104 takeoffs and landings, plus one car crash on that trip. And a number of films came out of that for IDRC, and that really began my full filmmaking career, if you like, and when I got much better at making films.
That's a really neat thing about your overall progression that you cover in this book, is you really see how you start out just beginning, trying to put it together, learning from people who are willing to help you, and really developing just this strong sense of what you need to do, how to navigate all of the interesting little tricky things that you mentioned of like trying to travel with your equipment and ship things, figuring out a lot of that as you go along. And you go through these kind of stages of growing and learning, and then it really starts to come together a bit more as you take those next steps. And so tell us a little bit about kind of where all of this led and how you took your learning and your skills and everything to the next level.
Well, after about 12 years of making films for IDRC, just about every subject in development, working in agriculture, post-harvest technology, education, doing films in fisheries and aquaculture, water and sanitation, rural development, agroforestry or multipurpose trees, bamboo and rattan in China and Southeast Asia, I guess I was a little bit exhausted from doing that. Very hard on the back.
Yeah.
And I produced about 30 films for IDRC, which was something that really made them quite popular on educational television around the world for educating developing country researchers. I mean, it was really research that we covered. But after about 12 years of that, they gave me a sabbatical at Tallahassee's Florida State University to do a master's. I did a master's in science and communication, and that was a real challenge because I had to do 9 semester courses and write a thesis in 11 months. That's, I had one year to do all the work and get back to Ottawa to go to work.
Oh, wow.
That shifted my career. And I stayed with IDRC for another year, but then I was hired by UNICEF and found myself and my family suddenly working in Bangladesh, where I worked for 4 years as the head of a communication team for UNICEF. That's the United Nations Children's Fund. That really shifted my career into organizing and developing multimedia communication, including film, video. We got into video because really I was taught before this, I was really working in 16 millimeter film, educational film. Video really didn't come in until the 1990s.
So you've seen some drastic changes in the technology over your career. What was that like trying to adapt over time? Because really, it seems like you've seen a little bit of everything at this point, probably.
Until I joined UNICEF, I was working, as I mentioned, as almost a one-man film crew. Sometimes I would hire a local sound man. Sometimes I would bring a staff member along and train them up on taking the sound. And we depend on really a lot of the project staff in developing countries we met to help carry the equipment, all the assistance to do that. It was heavy, heavy equipment. When I became a chief of communication for UNICEF Bangladesh, it really was more organizing, fundraising, and dreaming up projects that would make a difference in behavior and social change. And I think my most successful project in those days was the MENA Communication Initiative on the South Asian girl. And this dealt with child rights right through South Asia. We researched all the stories. I wanted to do stories rather than messages. I really wanted to get people into all the issues through stories. And I used animated film. I hired one of the premier animation gurus in South Asia, Ram Mahan, and I hired a team of very creative Asians and one British woman who really took the whole thing. I had a dream and they put it together. So I was really more of a director or a executive producer in a way of that whole series of animated films, comic books, and it went into every kind of different communication media that I was involved with. That film is still going, that series is still going to a certain extent Asian countries today. And there's a MENA Day, September 24th, every year in Bangladesh that commemorates MENA, and it became enculturated into the culture of Bangladesh especially, but also to a certain extent in some other countries like Nepal.
That's really amazing to be able to take something, you know, that you're approaching as a project for one thing and see it develop into this long-lasting initiative that really reaches a lot of people and goes probably, I'm assuming, beyond the original scope of what maybe you guys expected it to reach.
Right. I was challenged to do this. And soon after I joined UNICEF, I flew to Prague to an animated film and development workshop or conference. Maybe 200 people from around the world were there in Prague, Czechoslovakia, in 1990. And I met Bill Hanna from Hanna-Barbera, an executive director of UNICEF, said, "Neil, I want you to work with Bill Hanna and come up with a project." So there I was, a lowly communication officer from Bangladesh, and there was the executive director, very famous man, James P. Grant, telling me what I had to do. Actually, it came up, I went back to the hotel room, I was kind of jet-lagged, and in the morning I woke up with this idea of this little girl in my mind. It was like a waking dream. But it was the people I hired and the support from UNICEF New York that I got in fundraising to do this series, and the keeping that team together, gelling people, inputting from across South Asia and all the countries involved, that's what made it last. And I learned how to build teams, how to facilitate while I was in Bangladesh. That was the big change. I became a manager and a facilitator, and learning how to manage properly, not sticking your head in and doing everything, really empowering people to come up with ideas and do the work.
Well, I think that's such an important aspect of just managing in general, of building that relationship of trusting the people you work with and supporting them where they need support, but giving them that room to do what they need to do. I noticed that as you were talking about it, just how in your book, giving that group effort to bring something together to really put, like you said, these stories, because I think that is such a wonderful approach that you came up with in this, wanting to do it through stories rather than messaging, and how your team was really able to get behind that concept of sharing more than just, you know, a few keywords. I think especially now today, like on social media, we get used to just these, you know, little blips, TikTok videos, you know, things that last 30 seconds. And you guys taking the approach of really sharing a part of a life, of really telling what this means on a personal level to people, and having your group, your staff, be able to put those ideas together in a really obviously meaningful way that it's had such an impact as it did in that area. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, because even early on when you're first describing your films as a volunteer and working for CUSO, you're really focused a lot on the story aspect and telling the world what's happening either with the research or with these volunteer teachers, of showing people this is a really worthwhile thing to invest in or become part of. And seeing that focus again later on in your career with that MENA project, tell me a little bit more about that and that focus and how that developed over time.
Well, I tried to make the films I was making could be documented in a very dry way, and I tried to make them entertaining and engaging as much as possible. So, yes, you have to, for instance, filming CUSO volunteers, you just don't show the work. You have to show, okay, how does this guy or girl work, and how do they live in the community, and what do they eat, and where do they shop? How much fun was this? Was it all just hard work? You know, I did go to some very difficult postings, like northern Ghana, where we're out there filming and the car breaks down and we have to walk 4 miles in 130 degrees Fahrenheit weather. There were rough postings that people that I documented, but there was also a lot of interesting stories there that I picked up and kept. Fortunately, I kept a lot of notes. I kept a lot of letters, so I was able to write these stories. When I got to IDRC making films on research that was on development research being carried out around the world, I made trip reports, and I caught the humorous incidents that happened, and I worked those into my most recent book. I really tried to make it light in the sense of covering the subject and showing what happened to the projects and what happened to the research, but also incidents that I was talking about, the car crash in West Africa that happened in a rural area. The driver, a Muslim man with four wives, his youngest wife was having a baby. So I described how we were going too fast on a gravel road that has got that washboard effect when it's not graded all the time. We slid over into the other side of the road, and the Land Rover just went upside down and back into the bush and back on its wheels. So I talked about that quite a bit in the beginning of that filming for IDRC. We survived somehow, although all the windows were broken and we couldn't find the jack to lift up the car to one flat tire. But the driver went out on the road and brought back a whole village that used a hardwood pole to somehow lift that Land Rover and change the tire and headed back to Dakar, Senegal, the capital of Senegal. So stories like that I know that that's what captures people's attention. Not that they were in all the films I made, but they certainly are in the book I wrote. The same with the making of, I think my most successful film was documentary film was Prescription for Health, which is really about the transmission of diarrheal diseases. I don't want to be too graphic here. I am a little more graphic in the book, but I learned how to use animated film to show the fecal oral root of disease, diarrheal diseases, which at that time were killing about 5 million kids every year in developing countries. My film became successful and part of the whole work used around the world to teach people the root of disease in an animated film using it. When I got to working with UNICEF and the MENA project and later a SARA adolescent girl project in Africa, it was letting the scriptwriter write a story, but then researching that story and getting feedback from thousands of people over the whole number of episodes we did, and villages, and getting the headman's opinion on, and getting girls and boys' opinions, and also getting, you know, having focus groups with the parents separately and say, what do you think about this? That changed a lot of the stories. So it was really learning through research methods. I learned at Florida State University, Tallahassee. And I was able to apply those right away in the job I had after that.
I think it's so interesting how similar it is to writing a fictional story, for one, but how much information from outside of, you know, just your focused skills on what you're doing really comes into play in storytelling. I think it's interesting all the feedback and the focus groups and reaching out, doing the research to figure out what really are the important points that we need to be covering. So much of that really sounds like a lot of the same work I've done on, you know, building a fictional story, you know, checking in with the readers who you're targeting, getting that important feedback from readers and writers. And I think that just so much goes back to that storytelling aspect of what are you trying to get across and how do you do that in a way that really has an impact on your reader or viewer and makes that connection with them.
Right. After UNICEF, I was in UNICEF for 11 years. I went to Johns Hopkins University Center for Communication Programs. And these guys had really turned that into an art, a researched storytelling method. It really was called entertainment education. By that time, social change and behavior change messages were being infused in sitcoms around the world. So it really had taken off by that time. So I came to the right group to work with, and I was given the tools to do the same kind of work in Asia. And then in Russia, of all places, they wanted me to go to Russia. I said, me go to Russia? I don't speak Russian. But they wanted a project, the U.S. government wanted a project chief change. They wanted a new project leader of this project. They had 1 5-year program. And I went to Russia, and so I was challenged with working with a team of about 18 Russians in the project team that was hired. And trying to work out how to do this through, half of them were pretty good in English, but you know, there was a lot of translation as well, especially when I went to work with government people. That was, I think, one of my most challenging posts, believe it or not. That was in 2004 to 2007, when it was becoming politically challenging too, with Vladimir Putin in a second term. So it was quite a difficult diplomatic thing to do, working for an American project in Russia at the time, because basically he was starting to put the screws on everything.
Can't imagine what complications that added to an already challenging project.
But again, a lot of our work was storytelling, and I would say that I had a really great team, very, very hardworking and cooperative Russian young people, really, who really just finished university in a number of different branches of their studies. And they came together and really helped me and the project and Johns Hopkins University create something. There's 2 chapters in my new book on working in Russia, which I think readers will find quite interesting and humorous. A lot of different challenges.
Definitely. Well, and I knew talking to you, I was going to run out of time for all of my many, many questions because you had so many great stories and interesting things to talk about. I do want to mention before we wrap up, there's a whole other side of this story, and that's of you and your wife and how you meet and how your relationship develops over time, and then you build your family. While you're traveling the world and doing all these projects, I really enjoyed that aspect of the book as well. And I just wanted to ask you, how did you guys do it? Because that just seemed really challenging to kind of hold everything together and keep that connection going. And then while you're traveling, and especially after she has, you know, you guys start having kids, and I think it was with your first son, you had to leave on a project shortly after he was born. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like to keep that together and make it work was pretty impressive.
I had to get back for his birth, and I just did it on time. And then I had about two months. Well, I guess we started off that way because we met, she's an American artist, and we met in Japan by fluke, and that's mentioned more in my first memoir, Finding Myself in Borneo. But in this one, I describe our wedding in Zambia. She, when I went back to Japan to meet her, she said, well, I said, should we get married? And she was scratching her head about that. And because we hardly knew each other, we really spent a couple of weeks together total. And before I left Japan, I said, come to Africa with me. I'm going there. She said, sure, I'll marry you. I scratched my head, just scratched her head. Well, that's what happened. She flew to Zambia. And we got married in the district office of Lusaka. And I guess it was that sort of, we worked out distant relationships in the absence of cell phones and emails and all of that, no computers, letters. I have a whole stack of letters, and I think a lot of that that she saved and all my letters, so I really was able to recall all of that. That's how you had to work those days. People didn't expect instant gratification. One day at a time, we say.
That's a good rule to live by. And we are out of time. I had like a million more questions for you, but limited to the show length. But I did want to remind people. So the book is My University of the World, Adventures of an International Film and Media Maker by Neil McKee. I really hope people check it out because it just has so many wonderful, fascinating stories about the work you did and your life in general and just your family and all of the interesting things that you got involved in and got to learn about. And it's really a wonderful book. I enjoyed reading it very much. So thank you for that opportunity. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and tell me more about your book and your writing, and tell people where can they find you online and follow what you're doing and what you have going on next.
Thank you very much. I'm on Neil, NeilMckee, author.com. And you may find my videos on NeilMckeeVideos.com. That's all the main projects I have done. What I'm doing next, I think I'm going to do some writing on New Mexico and the Rocky Mountains, but I haven't quite figured that out. I've been reading like mad for the last year and a half on the history of New Mexico and this fantastic, interesting land that I live in now.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to hearing more about that when you're ready, and keep me in the loop. It'd be great to talk to you again.
Thanks very much.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.